We have time to do some Q&A. So why don't we do this, kind of open forum. If you want to, if you have a question, just go ahead and leave your hand up. You'll get pointed on. We'll tag you, stand up, and make sure you speak loud so everybody can hear you.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I have two quick questions. The first one is about the specific way the reactions in the components, there's slow weak reactions, quick strong reactions, and slower, long-lasting, short-lasting impressions. I'm guessing the impressions are whatever the impressions they took for what they reacted to. But with regards to telling you what your temperament is, reactions to what exactly?
In any kind of stimuli. So you're reacting to, one example is that Art's given in the past is, like he's driving down the highway and this guy cuts him off and nearly kills him. And he comes home that night and he's like, oh my gosh, I could have been killed. And the reaction was delayed. And so like that's an external stimuli. Or another example is the same external stimuli, especially with kids, you'll notice this, the same external stimuli will have a different effect in kids even within the same family, so showing that, you know, you can have kids of all different temperaments within your own, in your own family. But like another example that we like to give is the our kids, there were all these little kids at a matinee showing four children of Beauty and the Beast at our kids' school, high school, and there was always a small group of kids in the lobby in tears, inconsolable. This is a show for children, and they're in the lobby. All the rest of the kids are in watching the matinee, and what had happened was the Beast came out. So the Beast, all the kids in the watching the matinee are, you know, the musical are like, oh, Beauty and the Beast, you know, the Beast is so exciting, and so, you know, they're all thrilled. And then there's these few who are in the lobby clinging to their parents' knees, you know, who cannot be extricated and can't go back because they're in such a state of trauma. And it's like, well, that's a different reaction to the same stimuli. And those children were the melancholics. anyway, but they just had an intense reaction. It just went deep and long lasting, and they were terrified. And it wouldn't be, and the reason it's important to know about this, especially with kids, is that it doesn't work to say, come on, just get back in there. Come on, you know, grow up. What's wrong with you? You know, just go back. Because it really is terrifying for them. It isn't something you just like shove them back in there and they're going to get, you know, you don't just throw them back in the water in the swimming pool, you know, and hope they're going to swim. So actually what they found in research, and there has been research on it, if you force a child to go completely against their temperament, it's not going to go well. They'll double down on it, you know. So, because it's so ingrained, part of them. So the best ways in that situation would be to, you know, kind of slowly work into them getting back in the room.
By the way, it's a really good question. If I get this follow-up. The contemporary psychologists studying temperament are really studying more reactions like that. Short-lived or immediate, do you hold on to it, you let go? They'll have kids, young kids in a room, and they'll bring a stranger in. It's not mommy and daddy walking in. Someone they don't know walks in. And they found some very interesting ways that kids react to that. Are they curious? Are they terrified? Or they're terrified and then 30 seconds later they're off playing. Or they're terrified and they don't stop being terrified. All these are kind of the kind of equations you were looking at, are really what a lot of social scientists are looking at. And as far as they can tell, this is not so much environmental, it seems to be temperament. Temperament is more...
They're looking at babies.
Looking at babies. So yeah. That's the area, really, that the contemporary psychologist, sociologist, kind of looking at temperaments, is looking at stuff like that. And it invites us as parents just to be more aware of that as well. So, yeah, somebody over... Father.
You covered your book, and some people have been asking today, trying to figure out their temperaments. The question is, like, can temperaments change either due to some trauma, some big event, or simply because somebody realized early in life, oh, I have this problem, or I'm this way, so it worked against it. So some people are naturally one way, but they can't recognize that because they've worked so hard on the opposite.
That's a really good question. And this come up, some people come up. I think generally, where we think our work, temperament presumes a certain kind of non-traumatic introduction to life. I think a trauma can kind of reconfigure it. So I think generally, if you're saying, what is my temperament? it's like, what are your druthers and your preference, all things being equal, and that's not been overly impacted by a terrible trauma. Trauma is not terribly uncommon. It's becoming more common, but I do think, at least psychologically, you got to kind of deal with the trauma first, and then you can see if the temperament can come into play. A good example would be, let's say you're really a loud, kind of rambunctious sanguine or whatever, and you grow up in a family where there's a real grumpy, you know, kind of a mean grump alcoholic dad sitting there, when I come home, I want no noise, and you're like many people have grown up in a house like that. Well, you can be sanguine, but you can't be outgoing because you're going to have to go fight or flight. You're going to have to go up against it or leave. So those kind of things are not terribly uncommon. So we probably should have said this clear in the beginning. It presumes a certain kind of healthy kind of raising so that the natural gifts and temperament gifts can kind of flower. Now, sometimes what happens with people, if they do kind of address the trauma or overcome it somehow by life or prayer or just health or psychology or just kind of move on, that they can kind of be reawakened what their temperament is. But sometimes in traumatic situations, it forces you into such a narrow response pattern that the real gifts of your temperament can't be revealed. By the way, somebody was asking earlier about if you want to take the temperament test. Do you know what that website is off the top of your head?
Yes.
You tell them?
It's temperamentquiz.com. And it's a really short test. And it'll come up with your primary and secondary temperament. So, yeah, that's a good one. Temperamentquiz.com. And the other thing is, the other half of the question, I think, that Father was asking is that sometimes we do change. Well, obviously, we do change in life, and we grow because we grow, and ideally, we're growing in virtue. And so we like to say in our book that your temperament may not change, but you certainly can grow in virtue, and you should. So, for example, when you look at the lives of the saints, you see, you have to kind of read their biographies, or, you know, to go back to what they were like when they were children, to find out what their temperament was, because by the end of their life, they're so Christ-like that they would say, for example, about St. Ignatius of Loyola, they had no idea that he was, you know, such a feisty, choleric. And then by the end of his life, he was, you know, so Christ-like and humble, and, you know, he had grown so much in virtue. But it was just, you know, by listening to what his peers at the time knew about him that you would find out what his temperament was. So we are all called to become Christ-like. So we're all called to grow and change and grow beyond our temperament. And it's just good to know what it is so that we aren't stuck in it. We're more likely to get stuck in it if we don't know what it is. So knowing what our potential strengths are and our potential weaknesses are based on our temperament, we are more likely to be able to make progress in our growth and virtue because we can sort of target those areas where we struggle with. So, okay, other questions?
Yes, sir.
So there seem to be, in relationships, seem to be natural pairs of temperaments. So what I've seen a lot are sanguines with melancholic, for example. Do you think there are natural mismatches that don't seem to work well?
I don't. We've gone kind of back and forth on this. I think when you see two temperaments, like I remember I had some clients once who were both extreme melancholics, and they were in for counseling, and the problem they had, well, they got their taxes done on time, their house was very neat, everything was in order, but they didn't have much fun. didn't have much fun. Not too much pizzazz going on there for their liking. And that's really why they came in. They go, I'm going to get all this stuff together. So they, as a couple, struggled with that part of life. It's kind of funny how we solved it. All right, get out your calendars. Let's schedule some time for vacation. And they would go back and forth. They'd schedule it. They'd go back and forth what they're going to do and how they're going to have fun. They got all organized. I said, okay, when you get there, don't say what it is. Just say spontaneity will happen when you're in the Caribbean. It will just happen. So there's an example where they're deeply in love, but as a couple, they had some holes in their game that they wanted to kind of grow out of. Now, if one had been different temperaments, that probably wouldn't have been a problem. There's usually somebody that says, the heck, we're going to go spend some money and go to the Caribbean or kind of thing. So that, but I think the way God has put it, love is bigger than all this. And the real thing is real respect. If you really have respect for someone who's different than you or the same as you, I think you can overcome all these things. But you will have some holes. Like Lorraine and I, neither one of us are very good on details as well. I don't know why that is exactly. I think it's her fault more than mine.
It's actually his fault, so. Oh, and I was going to say, plug for our book, The Temperament God Gave Your Spouse. Because in it, we did describe real life cases of temperament combinations of every single combination. And so there, we know people, and of course it's all disguised, so nobody's real name is in there, nobody's real situation, but we really know people of every different temperament kind. So though it does seem, as you said, that more people do tend to often, you know, they're attracted to the opposite. And so you do find more of that, but it's perfectly fine to have all different combinations.
Yeah, so I want to be clear, we don't think there's any natural affinity or natural collision by the temperaments. Yeah, so that's our take. Yeah. Ma'am.
In your book, you discuss how the temperaments have pairs that are opposites.
Right.
And you really can't have those in a balanced person.
Yeah.
But you said you have an editor who's uniquely...
No, he finally caved in. Oh, no, I argued with him. Oh, no. He insisted that he was sanguine, melancholic, and I argued with him until he admitted that he was actually turned out he was choleric, melancholic.
So the question also is,
sorry.
So I understand how in your book you say, well, you can't be both this and this because they're opposite. Well, can't you be in one respect at a different time? One way and another way, or is it just not? You're talking about tendencies, so you can't be a tendency over here and a tendency over there. It's supposed to be across the board tendency.
No, it. We kind of maybe sounds. We sound like maybe too dogmatic in that. You know, in that book.
We were younger.
That was our first book. No, I mean, I think we're just stating our opinion on this, and we just think that there's a lot of times when people come up. First of all, nobody ever comes up and says, I am a choleric phlegmatic, by the way. Nobody has ever said that. So that gives you a clue. They know that they're not going to be both argumentative and hate arguments. So, you know what I mean? It's like, it just never happens. So, similarly, though not as obviously, a lot of times when people say, I think I might be a sanguine melancholic, what they really mean is that they are, as our editor, he was an Italian. He was an Italian melancholic. And so he finally came to terms with that. So he had a lot of sanguine characteristics from his background, from his cultural background. So
that's just our team.
Yeah, it was just kind of the logic of it didn't make sense to us, like Lorraine said. That was really it. But, you know, I don't know. I don't think there's a whole lot writing on that. As you grow... You must, well, I'll give you an example. I'm melancholic, phlegmatic, and if you've never seen me before, but see me today, go, this guy never stops talking. He's a big ham. Kind of am. But so I can do this. It's taken me 40 years. I'm 65. I can do this. I enjoy it and stuff. Here's the difference. If we get home tonight, about 2 hours from now, I'm just going to collapse. Boom. Lorraine's going to go, hyperdrive. Let's do more things, you know what I mean? Because of her temperament, she can just do this all day long. I can do it, but... It's a little bit more, it's not as natural for me, but I can learn to do it. I can learn to do it. I'm a phlegmatic CEO for a company of, I don't know, $15 million, not the biggest thing in the world, but I got to act choleric all day long, what you traditionally call choleric tendencies. Some of them I'm pretty good at, some not. But I do some things that other clerics don't do. I have a person here that I pay as a consultant to keep me on track. I have to work, read all these business books. I got to go to these trainings and stuff because it doesn't come naturally to me. See what I'm saying? So you can, yeah, well, you don't want the, like I said in the beginning, we don't want the temperaments put in the box. I mean, that would be against everything that kind of Christ wants. But it just to be aware of a tendency so you can help yourself grow. That's all. Yeah. Yes, sir.
First of all, thanks for being here. We really appreciate it.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you. Yeah. There's always one in every crowd.
In preparation for it, I got on your website and started kind of doing some research. And the first thing I thought was, wow, how cool this guy is doing this business with his daughter. This was really good. But have a favor, take a picture of you, sir.
You want to take a picture of me?
Yeah, JC.
Oh, we're twins? Is this my long lost twin? JC! No, I'll be honest, it was called a bishop. A bishop may incline me to do it. Bishops are more powerful than wives when you work for the church. So I was, nobody made me do it. I did it my free will. It's only here it grows. I should have done it. Okay, yes, ma'am.
Do you have some advice for a choleric sanguine who's trying to homeschool a melancholic?
A choleric sanguine trying to homeschool a melancholic?
Yeah, a melancholic who tends to get, she was describing the kids, he didn't get fearful like that of stuff, but yeah. His schoolwork, he gets stuck.
Well, you know what, right here I have a choleric sanguine homeschooled for 10 years. Let's ask her.
Well, okay, I know exactly what you're talking about, but here's the thing about melancholics, especially melancholic children. They just get better. They're like fine wine. They get better the longer it goes on. So they can have, because they can have a real slow start to school. Our melancholic got a Psy D, so she's like, you know, brilliant. And but you know, they're slow in the beginning. I would say they can be fearful to try new things. Like you said, that could be.
Well, he started out really great, and he's a perfectionist.
Oh, okay.
And I think it says the schoolwork is getting a little harder.
Yeah.
He's harder on himself. And
yeah.
He's very depressed. And
oh, that's classic.
With
oh. Yeah.
And I'm like, snap out of it. Just do your work.
That's like I work. You're
a psychologist.
Well. Yeah, so even the brief overview of melancholics, they don't start new things real quickly. New is hard, so they do take a while to adapt. That's what I think is really insightful, right? Yeah, they are. You want to kind of stretch the playing field to give them more. They just need more time. Those kids that are crying for Beauty and the Beast, most of them probably were melancholics, but 10 years later, most of them won't have any trauma. It just takes them longer. So I think that's the best way to look at it. On the other hand, the skills of melancholics. Yeah, be patient. Yeah, that's it. Haranguing them, why can't you be more like me or be like them? That doesn't terribly effective. The other hand, you do want to kind of also kind of get that broader vision. What are the skills they tend to bring to the table? They're very great skills. They're unbelievably faithful. If you have a melancholic friend, you got a friend for life usually. They are that kind of thing. And then their ability to go deep into things. A lot of that is just not appreciated in a culture which is so fast and rapidity and stuff. So I think sometimes homeschooling is a nicer pace for the melancholic to blossom. So I think it's patience is the thing. And they may never be as full of pizzazz and outgoing that you might want. Just like they're probably wishing you might be a little bit more slower and slower, but it works itself out. Yeah, but I think patience is the great virtue with melancholics, and they're so true blue as a rule. They're so faith-filled and interior, but those are organically, those things take longer to come out. That's great. I like that. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. Empathic, got it. Okay, right.
What about people who are naturally really inclined to be empathetic, like to the point where it becomes an affliction? Like, how would they know when to step back and say, I need to kind of, you know, give myself the room to not feel so
affliction? Right. So, how, if you're empathic, how to not get overwhelmed by that? Yeah. Well, I think that's a really good question. It's really common too. I think that to remember, empathy is only this. Oh, it's golden. It's only this. I want to understand what you said and how you feel. After that, well, for example, when John Paul II went and visited the guy that shot him, I'm the Pope, I feel like visiting the guy that shot me. Okay, let's go talk to the guy that shot you. He met with him. We don't know what was said. I don't think he commented on it. We don't know. But here's what we do know is after he had that very intense discussion, he didn't say to the jailer, let him out of jail, back in the streets. He did not say that. This guy needs to be in jail a long time, right? So he loved him, but he didn't go outside of the bounds of sense and common sense and the common good, so to speak. So it's the same thing. It's like, okay, I'll listen. Like, this happens a lot with the audience that we deal with, the Catholic Charities, the people on the very bottom, the people so desperate in life. You meet with them and you talk to them with great empathy and love. You offer something that maybe will help. So I can get you into a you know, homeless shelter tonight. That's what you like. No, I don't want that. I hate those places. Okay, that's really all I have to offer. If you ever change your mind, let me know. Here's my card. So that kind of, that's the balance. To say, I'm not God. I don't have any great powers or anything. I can understand you, and I can empathize with you. I hate those places because they're kind of, the people there are so discourteous or whatever. But you know, it's 22 degrees outside. Can you just kind of hang in there one night? No, I hate the. Okay, I understand. You hate those places that you really put yourself at risk. Rather than go there. That's right. I don't have anything else up my sleeve right now. I'm sorry, I can't help you. Here's my card. We can try tomorrow. So that's a different thing. By the way, you really make a really good point. Some people don't want to be empathic because they think they'll get seduced into a realm of being taken advantage of or being abused or being a doormat. And that can happen. That can happen. But at least cognitively know, and you learn this as a therapist, you learn this is I'm going to be empathic and loving to you, but there's only so much I can do. I'll do that. And then, of course, the other thing, which is not trivial from a Catholic point of view, is I promise to pray for you. And that's not like, oh, yeah, I throw in the prayer thing. Well, I'm throwing the prayer thing. He's the big guy. He can do anything. Does that make sense? So you have to keep, you don't want it to slide into just being run over. You know? That's a really great question. Yes, sir. Understood all you said. If I didn't, we can talk afterwards. Sometimes you apologize to someone or say you're sorry or whatever. They don't really accept it, or they don't really take credence in it. That is a risk every day, that we can ask someone to forgive us, and they may or may not do it. It's Christ wants us to do that, I think, but I can't make someone forgive me or take someone look beyond that. So that's right, it is a risk, and it doesn't always work out the way you want, but I think we are, when we have done something wrong to someone, we should ask for forgiveness and try to repair the damage, even though that it may not take. That's a good point. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
The website is different. It's a quicker and probably more accurate because it kind of gives little percentages of, you know, primary and secondary temperament. I don't know. It's fun, and it'll ask you for an email address. But if you don't like giving emails, you can just make up one. That's what my daughter told me. I was like, oh, you can do that? She's like, yeah. Like, oh, okay, cool.
Thank you very much, you guys. God bless.
Thank you.